You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, and I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust. My guest this week is Victoria Miguel, who fell in love with John Cage when she was in college during an art history lecture at the University of Edinburgh. After graduation, she moved to New York to work with me at the John Cage Trust, while simultaneously completing an MA degree in liberal studies at the New School University. Her thesis was an imaginative exploration of the work of John Cage and Samuel Beckett through their shared interest in chess. She has become something of a specialist advisor on John Cage on a variety of projects, including a 2007 exhibition of Cage and Cunningham's nature-inflected drawings at Inverleith House in Edinburgh, and an exhibition entitled Invention, Merce Cunningham and Collaborators at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts in Manhattan, also in 2007. For the latter, she oversaw the creation of the accompanying publication, and more recently, in 2018-19, the publication that accompanied the exhibition and sound installation John Cage Ryoanji at Gallery Thaddeus Ropack in London. Victoria has produced several programs of Cage's music, including Cage in the Garden in 2007 at the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh, which featured performances by the Whistle Binkies and So Percussion. Appropriately, she programmed compositions by Cage that use amplified plants and natural materials as instruments, as well as works that incorporate local ambient sounds, including his infamous 4 minutes and 33 seconds. In 2012, for Cage's centennial, the John Cage Trust commissioned Victoria to develop an online version of Cage's chess-based composition, Reunion, from 1968, which premiered in tandem with her play, L'Aquaria, at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe in 2013. The programming for Digital Reunion is the work of Professor Ian Miguel and Chris Jefferson of the University of St. Andrews School of Computer Science. This interactive chess game is hosted online at the John Cage Trust's website. In 2012, Victoria co-founded a curatorial and publishing company, Smith & Brown. After her return to the UK, her first public event was a recreation of Cage's infamous first happening, the Black Mountain College event, also known as Theater Piece No. 1 from 1952. Victoria's program, entitled Instructions Event, incorporated work by visual artist Rudolf Stingel, a new work by Richard Wentworth, new choreography by Julie Cunningham, and contemporary music performed by the Hermes Experiment. And in 2017, to celebrate Smith & Brown's publication, Alana Pagnuti's Reception, the Radio Works of Robert Rauschenberg and John Cage, she produced a performance of Cage's ubiquitous Water Walk from 1959, performed by Arthur Bruce at London's Café Otto. In the autumn of 2019, synchronous with Merce Cunningham's centennial, she produced Me Want a Music Day 2019, a day-long celebration of Cage and Cunningham that echoed their spirit of collaboration, their ideas about teaching, and their nurturance of contemporary art and culture. This marked the 50th anniversary of Me Want a Music Day, which Cage originally staged on the campus of UC Davis at the conclusion of his residency there in 1969. And most recently, in 2020, Victoria began a PhD in English literature at the University of Glasgow on the subject of John Cage's literary works. So welcome to All Things Cage, Victoria. Victoria, you and I, truly, we could talk for hours about anything in my introduction and things that weren't even in the introduction, like our time with Merce at the end of his life. Victoria was really my other arm. But I think that what we should do is focus our attention today on John Cage's Reunion, which is, I'll describe it in a second, but Victoria, one of the major things that she's done that I alluded to in the introduction was to create a digital version of this chess game, which lives now on the website of the John Cage Trust. So anybody can go and play and hear. So let me do a little introduction to that, and then we'll talk about Digital Reunion, Vic, okay?
Okay.
So for the listening audience, John Cage created Reunion with his colleague Lowell Cross in 1968. It is an event originally performed by two people playing a game of chess on an electrified chessboard created by Cross. The game works as an indeterminate structure. As a game of chess is played, the moves of the players on the board activate the sounds of live performance by four musicians and distribute them to eight speakers that surround the audience. For the premiere performance, which took place at the Ryerson Institute in Toronto, the musicians were Gordon Mumma, Lowell Cross, David Behrmann, and David Tudor, all four being very close friends and colleagues of John Cage. Two games were played. The first was Cage against Marcel Duchamp, who had taught Cage to play chess. This game lasted only half an hour, despite Duchamp's handicap. He played with only one knight. The second game was played Cage against Duchamp's second wife, Tini. This game remained unfinished at 1 a.m., at which point a sleepy Duchamp memorized the last moves and positions of the pieces. The game was finished in New York 5 days later. Tini won. That must have galled Cage no end.
Tini was a very good player, though. I think she won quite a lot.
Tini was a very good player. I actually was able, had the good fortune of spending time with Cage and Tini in Tini and Marcel's home in Villiers-sur-Grez in France. And I mostly read books in the library and took baths in the Nikki de Saint Phalle hippopotamus bathtub in my room. But John and Tini played chess incessantly. What I mostly remember about this is the silence of their game, how quiet it was, except for whenever Tini would win, John would say, "Aren't you marvelous?" It was a very sweet time. Anyway, so Victoria, as I said in my introduction, Victoria was commissioned really by the John Cage Trust to look at the possibility of creating reunion for having a kind of digital presence, a presence on the internet, perhaps. What year was this, Vic? Do you remember?
2011 leading into 12, because it was a Cage centenary project. And then we didn't premiere them till 2013 because it took a while.
That's right. And so it was after Merce's death.
Yeah.
Had to consider, at least, I don't want to talk too much about what you did and let you talk about what you did, but you had to consider a lot of kind of adaptive strategies, if you will, for making a digital version. You want to talk about those?
Yeah. So I think the first thing to say is that this was the subject of my MA thesis at the New School, which I think you say in your introduction. So this already kind of existed, which is what you approached me with, which was, I really like this. Can we do something for it for the centenary? What could we do? So I started thinking about what we could do. And I've always had a real interest in Cage and technology and his use of technology. And the biggest problem with Reunion is that it hadn't really been performed much because it couldn't be performed much. So we sort of looked at working on the other end of that, which was to put it online, where there were lots of international chess games happening online. Chess and computers has a very strong and long history and relationship. So that's where we kind of started with that. But that means that the music can't be live, which is the biggest difference between the digital version of Reunion and real Reunion, is that real 1968 original Reunion works with turning on and off the audio on live performances and spreading them around those eight speakers. And that happens using the chessboard. But our version had to work with recorded music because you can't have that access to live music. You also don't have access to those kinds of speakers from a computer system either. So you don't get the sense of it moving around the room, which you do in a live performance.
Right. It's interesting, Vic. I'm picturing in my mind the many photographs we have of that first performance in Toronto and all the cabling. There was cable everywhere.
Yeah.
So who were the composers, just to fill out this picture? Who did you use for Digital Reunion?
We used Mark Thorman, who I was introduced to by you, and Lynn Wright, who is a friend of mine. Lynn had worked on some music for a piece I had done for Triple Canopy, which is a radio internet play, which was about language, that I had done for them in 2010. So I'd worked with him really recently, and he's really wonderful. And Jacob Carpenter Morris, who similarly, a young composer I had worked with on that same play, it had involved several composers. And the fourth piece we used was Cage's chess pieces from 1943. And I had a question for you about that, because I remember this being rediscovered as a viable composition during my time working for you at the Cage Trust. So I wondered if you could tell that story.
That's correct. So John Cage, when people ask about when did Cage begin to make visual artwork, chess pieces from 1943 is in fact the earliest one that we have. We do not own it, but we have documentation of it. It belongs in a private collection in Chicago where it was created. And it was created for a show at the Julian Levy Gallery called The Imagery of Chess. The time that you're speaking of is fast forwarding us 50, 60 years when the Noguchi Museum in, where is Noguchi? Long Island.
Long Island City, I think, yeah.
Long Island City, that's right, here in New York, wanted to do a new exhibition called Imagery of Chess Revisited. And they wanted to borrow the work. And because it's with an anonymous collector, if you will, we helped secure the work for loan to Noguchi Show. In having the actual physical work in our possession, we took that opportunity to make a beautiful high-res image of it for future documentation purposes. But it also raised the question, you might have been part of the group raising the question, Vic, and that was, is this a viable composition? Because for most people, I'll put a copy of the work on the broadcast page at WGXC so people can see what it looks like. It is basically 64 little squares in a kind of blue tone, and it is little squares of musical notation. So we enlisted the help of a pianist, Margaret Ling Tan, who had done a lot of Cage recordings, a lot of Cage performance, and she determined that it was a viable, absolutely playable piece. And it was thereafter published by our music publisher and available through C.F. Peters. So there you have it. That's the story.
One of the great discoveries. I remember you coming home after the Game Show Network called you about I've Got a Secret. I love those moments.
The truth is about that, the I've Got a Secret appearance, I didn't know about it when the Game Show Network called. You know, so I thought they were talking about Lascia Uradopia, which, by the way, I just did a show with Stefano Pucci about that just recently. And so I tried to talk the guy out of that. He didn't have, he was mistaken. And he was so out of it. He said, Laura, I have the Betamax in my hand. And I immediately, of course, talked to Merce about this. And I said, did you know that Cage was on I've Got a Secret? And Merce said, oh, yes.
I know, I was there. I was at the dinner with the two of you. Didn't he say something about... There was quite a famous actress in the studio at the same time. I know Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Zsa Gabor.
Yeah.
Zsa Zsa Gabor. The format of the show always took three contestants. Each one got like 10 minutes to do their thing. Cage ended up not being really a contestant, but more a performer. He presented. Yeah. So, oh, yes, Zsa Zsa Gabor. And her secret was that her dress was made out of a potato sack. That was her secret. And the contestants had to figure it out. It was very sweet. Anyway. I interrupted you though. Oh, chess pieces. So you must have used Margaret Ling Tam's recording.
I don't think we used her recording. I think Ian, my brother, who's the person who helped make it with Chris Jefferson, I think he made a recording to work from. In choosing the music, we wanted to do sort of two things. And one, I was kind of drilled by Merce of the importance of working with contemporary music and contemporary musicians and contemporary composers. So for needs of budget, and also with that in mind, we worked with young composers who were working, and we wanted to tie the old to the new, and Reunion didn't have any Cage music, technically. So it was a way of bringing chess pieces sort of back in, and it was another nod to Duchamp, because there is so much of Duchamp in Cage and his approach with chess, and in what I did with L'Aquaria, as well as Digital Reunion. So it just kind of fit in a nice way.
Uh-huh. Interesting, because it definitely has a contemporary sound. For those of you, if you're still a little unclear about this, when you play Digital Reunion at johncage.org, just click on Reunion, you immediately, upon moving your pieces and engaging in a game, will hear the sounds of these composers' pieces, which are, as Victoria says, not live at all, but rather recorded pieces. In Cage's and Duchamp's game, as well as Cage's and Tini's game, the four musicians were, in fact, live performers whose sounds were gated. So they were basically muted until they weren't. And the chessboard, if you look at, I'll also put up a picture of the chessboard at the broadcast page. So you can see the little holes in the board where the pieces mute the sound until they're moved. and then they mute something else. So it's really the whole system is one of gating and ungating sound.
I remember a really lovely story by John. I'm not exactly sure where I read it now, but it was about how well Marcel understood what the game entailed and what the composition was. And the fact that he was playing without one of his knights, he suggested that he put a coin on that square so that it worked as one of the gates, even though he wasn't using that piece, which I thought was really lovely.
Yes, in fact, one of the pictures that we have of the board is the Duchamp handicap picture, which is the knight on its side and a quarter sitting over the hole.
But you have a board now, right?
We do. Well, we have them both. We have the original board, which we don't loan, just because it's so potentially fragile, but also it's an original. So we commissioned the construction of a new board in 2010, which does go out for shows. Which we sometimes allow people to actually engage with the board, and sometimes it's just on view. It's a funny piece, you know, it's a funny object because it's extremely utilitarian, but on the other hand, it's also very beautiful. You know, it's, I don't know what kind of wood, it might be rosewood or something. It's incredibly beautiful.
I seem to remember it's made from chessboards. I mean, they're just literally sandwiched two chessboards together, didn't he?
I
Or
think
is that,
I don't
have I
know.
invented that?
I really don't know. But going back to Cage and Duchamp, I mean, Duchamp indeed was Cage's first teacher of chess. And it was through Duchamp that Cage actually developed a love for chess. But he also admitted that one time Duchamp apparently was irritated with him because he accused Cage of not wanting to win, that he wasn't paying enough attention. He didn't want to win. And Cage admitted that really he wanted to be near Duchamp. And it was a way to be near him because Duchamp loved the game.
There's a very funny story about Marcel's first marriage, which ended, I think, after only a few days, largely because when they were on honeymoon, Duchamp wanted to play chess, and she got so sick of it, she glued the pieces to his travel set down. It's like, this will not work.
That's a strategy. My first husband made wooden yo-yos and
Have one.
yes, you do. That you do. Anybody who's close to me has a Tom Kuhn custom yo-yo. I remember him, you know, obsessed with doing yo-yo tricks and learning how to navigate with his Tom Kuhn custom yo-yos, and me laying in bed watching him do these tricks and saying, yeah. When you can do 10 in a row, you know, wake me up, kind of thing, you know. Obsessions, you know, obsessions.
I read something recently about John, in the last couple of months at least, about John and chess, and that was that after Duchamp died, obviously he continued to study chess, and he ended up working with Bobby Fischer's teacher, who made him start reading the books about chess, because you have to, in order to really play, you have to read, you have to kind of commit, which I suppose is Duchamp's point. But he did commit somewhat afterwards, getting a scolding from Bobby Fischer's teacher.
No, I think that's true. And, you know, in all the time that I worked with him in New York, so we're talking 86 until his death, he played chess almost every day, every weekday at 5 to 6 with Bill Anastasi primarily, sometimes his friend Sean Bronzell, but mostly Bill. Cage would hold off having a glass of wine until the game was over at 6. And he would kick Bill out because Merce liked peace and quiet in the house when he came home. So he was really devoted. I have to thank you, by the way, for recommending that I watch The Queen's Gambit.
Oh yeah, it's
If
fun,
people
isn't it?
happen to watch this, I forget what it's on. Is it on Amazon or no, it's Netflix.
Netflix.
It's absolutely marvelous. If you haven't heard of it, do watch it. It's just a marvelous, marvelous show.
I've been thinking a lot lately about John and his hobbies. So obviously the beautiful Mushroom book just came out, and I think you've already done a program about that mycology book that came out last year. And just thinking about how that sits with chess as kind of indoor and outdoor hobbies, and that he was ready to kind of do these at any kind of second. And it was just, thinking about how we all are in lockdown and the kind of bleed between our work life and our personal lives, and just thinking how well it seems that John kind of regulated the other things in his life beyond his kind of creative work.
No, I think that's absolutely true. But I also think it's more direct in terms of there are striking, maybe just metaphorical relationships, but are allegorical in a way, between the process of foraging for mushrooms and the process of playing chess. I'm reminded of something that Cage once said. when somebody asked him about his devotion to chance operations, you know, and did he always use chance? And Cage responded very wryly that he would use chance operations, consult the I Ching on matters that he didn't care about the outcome. But he assured people that he never did it under three circumstances. And one was playing chess, one was foraging for mushrooms, and the other was making love.
Just the important things, keep them
Exactly.
separate.
Exactly. There was always a chessboard set up in the house, always. And he was always up for a game. I certainly know how to play chess, but I find it nervous making as a game. There's something about it that makes me feel anxious as I play it. So I never played chess with him.
I was just thinking about Merce, and I don't think Merce played, did he?
No, I don't think he even knew how to play. I really don't know.
Because the board was still set up, you know, when we were at Merce's all the time, it was still set up.
Yes, in the garden. Yeah, which by the way was another one of his hobbies. If you want to go there, I consider Cage's gardening a hobby. That, you know, the apartment, for those that don't know, the loft in Manhattan had, I don't know how many hundreds of plants in its heyday. That Cage, you know, probably took him an hour, between an hour and 2 hours a day, just caring for the plants. He used to say that the habit of a good gardener is to pull the brown things off, because everything was always so green. I was always like, how do you do that? You know, how do you keep everything so healthy? And it turned out he was just pulling off the brown stuff.
It's a good strategy.
It's true. Maybe let's not talk so much about digital reunion, but maybe talk about the use of digital reunion, if you will, in LaQuaria. So we'll talk about LaQuaria first. Tell the audience what LaQuaria is.
Okay, so at this kind of connects back to what we were just talking about. So the title, in fact, comes from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, the chess game section, and they talk about flinging their smoke up into the LaQuaria because when John and Marcel would play, of course, they were smoking constantly, and it was this very kind of smoky thing. But LaQuaria is also a genus of fungi, so it just seemed like a perfect title. But the piece itself is developed from my master's thesis, which put together two of my favorite things, which was Reunion, John's Reunion, and one of Beckett's novels, Murphy, which involves a game of chess, and the character who plays manically obsessed with chess is based on Duchamp, apparently. So it was kind of connecting those two things back again. So the thesis asked, could you perform Reunion by playing the chess game that's documented in Murphy? And the performance asked that question while also performing that game and playing this new version of Reunion. So that's essentially what it was. So it was an imaginary conversation, largely in their own words, between Samuel Beckett and John Cage. And there's a narrator who kind of interjects and gets things wrong, and there's a kind of comedic fool character. And then there's also a commentator who I invented entirely because the footnotes to the Murphy game are so beautiful by Beckett and so funny that you just had to find a way to include them, and there was no other way.
This was a
Yes,
play.
it was a lecture, a sort of lecture demonstration in the kind of tradition of Cage as well, of the kind of doing and talking about what you're doing at the same time. And it was at Summer Hall, and it was Summer Hall in Edinburgh. It's a really special venue. It was built up out of the old veterinary school of Edinburgh University. So the lecture hall we had, or the venue we had rather, was an old veterinary lecture hall. So you're looking down on sort of a medical practice. So it's absolutely perfect for watching a chess game kind of happen. Really lovely venue.
Again, I'll put up a picture of that so that people can see it. You also projected. What were the projections? Was it the game itself?
The projection was the chess game for Murphy. So those of you who don't know Murphy, I don't think it's a super well-known novel by Beckett of all of them, but the chess game is a pattern, actually. It's a function of Endon's madness that they just play this pattern and copy each other. So it is done in real chess moves, but it's not a real chess game as you would think of a game. So it's quite beautiful to kind of watch this kind of ebbing and flowing, and very graphic and very beautiful visually to look at also.
I remember being there, and I remember being struck, as you say, by the beauty of this veterinary theater, if you will, you know, because it was like operating theater. You could be, you know, you could imagine a, you know, a cat being dissected for educational purposes. You know, we're far enough away to not be too disgusted, and close enough to actually see what was going on. So it just seemed like a really wonderful place to be.
Yeah, and it sits within that really interesting tradition of Edinburgh and the medical school, and the Frankenstein is based on experiments in the Edinburgh Medical School, and it's sort of delightfully gruesome, gory connections to literature that neither Beckett nor Cage would ever have intended. But it was it was a really beautiful venue as well. And it had not been long open at that point. Summer Hall now has a really wonderful reputation in the world, but it was maybe 1 or 2 years old at the time. It wasn't so well known, but very special.
This was the Fringe Festival of 2013, right? And so that was, in point of fact, the premiere of L'Aquaria was also the premiere of Digital Reunion, was it not?
The same day, the same first performance, early in August.
And then it went up on the website.
Yeah, and it's been up ever since, and you can play it. And I think there's a wonderful essay by my brother Ian Miguel and Chris Jefferson that explains how they did it from a technical point of view, which I could not really begin to explain properly, but that sort of explains it. And it's impossible to reproduce. I mean, statistically impossible to play any two games to repeat the music. So every time you play it, it will be completely different, and you can play against the computer if you don't have someone to play against. So you can make the music by yourself, which is also a different feature of Digital Reunion compared to the original as well.
How does one play against another person? Are you playing on the same computer?
Don't recall.
I know. It's been a while. I had to revisit this myself, this reunion revisited.
I seem to remember that it's possible. I also seem to remember, and this would be again in the same essay by Ian and Chris, that even though your computer speakers won't allow it, they did build in the kind of moving across different speakers within, but you can't differentiate when you only have two outputs.
Of course,
But I
of
think
course.
that is in there.
Huh. So it has a spatial element to it. Were your
Sorry.
composers always present?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Were they always in the space when you did a performance? You did a couple of performances, did you not?
Oh yeah, no. In Edinburgh, no, none of the composers came because they were all New Yorkers, and we didn't have an enormous budget. They never came, but obviously they can play online, and that was something that they could do. And it's again rethinking about this, or thinking again about this to speak to you today, and just this idea of digital friendships as opposed to in-person friendships, which essentially what the difference between the original reunion and digital reunion is, that you and I could play chess, we're in different continents. We could do that now, as we can talk via Zoom or however. But it's the different, it's slightly different dynamic of friendship, I suppose, that it allows for.
There's a letter in, I included it actually in the selected letters of John Cage, but it's so apropos this conversation that there's a letter from Lowell Cross with a chess move. That's it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or it's a Cage responding to a letter, because it's actually the book is only Cage's letters out, but it's Cage's response in a chess move to Lowell. So they would play chess through the mails, which a lot of people used to do.
Yeah, and even I watched recent. Well, I watched in first lockdown. I watched the re relatively new film about the Bobby Fischer game in the 70s in Iceland, and just how that was relayed on ticker tape. That there is something about chess and international communication, and putting these symbols out into the world in a very quick way. That it's there is a strong relationship, or a strong history of relationship between those two things, which is quite nice.
I wonder if Marcel and Tini were living in New York at the time. They must have been. I think he was in New York.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been quite a trek for both of them, and he was not well.
yeah
Have you ever seen the documentary, this the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company's documentary of the game?
mm-mm.
Well, of the games. Actually, it's mostly a documentary of the first game of Cage and Duchamp. You've never seen it.
I don't well if I have, it would have been 20 years ago.
You would remember it because you see all these characters of not only Cage, who's very dapper. How old was he then? 56. He was born in 1912 and this was 68, so he was 56. He's wearing a long, kind of cashmere overcoat and smoking a cigarette in a long holder, and he's very coy in his conversations with the commentators.
Well, that's one thing we haven't talked about, which is the book, Shigeko Kubota's book, which is very beautiful, with mnasostics on Marcel Duchamp, right? That's the text, and the images, which are, I think, iconic. I mean, the one I used of Marcel and Tini and Cage sitting, the three of them, which I recreated. I don't know if you noticed it in
Of
the
course.
stage production, but
How could one miss?
I
No.
think everyone else missed it. And I was like, look.
Well, Shigeko Kubota, for those of you who don't know the name, Shigeko Kubota was the wife of Namjoon Paik. She outlived him for many years. She's now deceased, and her foundation, if you will, is situated in New York City. And she did this beautiful book called Marcel Duchamp and John Cage Reunion. And it is a book, as Victoria just described it, it's a book mostly of these photo plates of her own photography of everybody involved, really. But the iconic ones are really Cage, Marcel, and Tini, the three of them. It's richly illustrated. It has Cage's mathostics in it. It's covered in a kind of silver lettered blue cloth. It's got an acetate dust jacket. It's really beautiful. It's become this kind of collector's item because it's so ridiculously wonderful for
There's the recording.
I'm sorry.
And there's the recording.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. And the recording that's captured inside of it is we will listen to it at the end of this program. So it's just 7 minutes really of the first game of not the full game because that game lasted less than an hour, but certainly more than the 7 minutes of the recording, right?
Yeah,
Duchamp
it's
was
about
good, but he wasn't that good.
Well, we did have only one night.
That's true. That's true. So instead of 5 minutes, it took him 20. Okay.
I think one of the nicest things about that recording is the conversations at the beginning and at the end that you can hear. I mean, you can only just hear. I've listened to it several times. You can hear Tini reminding, I think, Marcel and John that, you're not in your living room, so sit up straight.
Right.
It's also good advice. Good
It's very
advice for
true
these days.
because it wasn't performed as a kind of, very sterile kind of situation. Cage and Duchamp, as Victoria alludes to, chain smoked through the whole thing. They've drank wine through the whole thing. But Duchamp is interviewed a little bit in the CBC documentary. It was featured, the game, the performance, the event, whatever you want to call it. And even people in the Cage world don't quite know what to call reunion, because it's not really a composition. It's a situation. It's a composed situation, if you will. But it was the subject of a CBC weekly news show. If memory serves, it was called The Day Is It. And it was just really all about this game. And they interviewed Duchamp when he comes in, and Tini. I remember in the show, somebody hands her a rose or a flower of some sort, and she says, mutters to Marcel, "Now what am I supposed to do with this?" Because she's been handed this flower, and she hasn't even taken her coat off, and it's kind of sweet. It does have a feeling of home, the whole atmosphere.
This is really ringing a bell. I think I have seen film of this or video of this at some point.
Good, good. We have a copy of it here at the Cage Trust, although it requires licensing from the CBC. So people get to look at it when they come to visit, but I can't just copy it and send it out willy-nilly. As Emmy and I, who I work with here at the Cage Trust, Emmy and I did a show and we both agreed and then laughed that the only way we can really get into trouble here is through breaking copyright laws. So I'm really sensitive to this. But it's a great show. I wish it were more widely available to people because it's a wonderful example of, as you were saying, Cage's kind of unfettered enjoyment of using technology and really stretching technology in its moment to do something. How do you put two chess players together with four live musicians with all the cabling involved for all of this, and the board is all wired up and transmit the sound of the musicians when they're supposed to be sounding and not when they're not. It's a fascinating piece, actually.
Yeah, but pleasure too. I mean, I think that's also, you can hear it in the recording. It's full of, when they're talking, it's full of laughter and, friendship, which the
Sure.
piece is about friendship. So there's all of that, working hard, doing interesting things, but there's the pleasure that you take in doing those things, sharing them with other people.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's interesting. Somebody wanted to borrow the chessboard, and I have to say that I put people through hoops when they want to borrow it because it's special, and I need to understand that they understand how the board is to be used and what the game is. And this person wanted to do it, but let something slip in our conversation, leading me to understand that he thought it was composed music, that it was not live music. And I had to explain it to him. And I also said, I remember talking with him at that point about he needed to really understand that the work is called Reunion for a reason, that it really does have to do with the bringing together of friends, you know, in this case, over a game of chess and bringing together musicians, all of whom knew each other, all of whom were part of the Cage and Cunningham circle. So it was a reunion of sorts with these people.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's been 20 years nearly, and it's still one of my favorite Cage pieces. It's,
Well,
I think.
2009 was the, what is that, 40th anniversary, right? Yeah, 2009 might have been 40th anniversary. So 19 would have been 50.
Yes.
I was thinking
Well,
about Merce's death. I'm sorry, I was thinking about Merce's death because Merce always thought that it would be really nice to do something for these anniversaries of reunion. And 2019 just wasn't going to come to pass. The Shigeko Kubota Foundation had expressed interest in doing something. The Cage Trust was absolutely game. And it turned out to be just a hideous time for everybody, at least of which the Cage Trust was in the middle of a big move. And the Kubota Foundation was relatively new at that time. So we missed our window. So maybe 60, maybe in 2020. Do you play chess? Is it something
No.
that you do? No, me neither. Me neither.
It's one of my I play chess. I know how to play chess. I don't have what I think John wasn't really John didn't really have, which is the desire to read books on chess and know really how to engage with chess. But I'm not good on games in general.
Not even Scrabble?
No, I just I don't really
You're a
I don't
word person. I would think that you would like Scrabble at least.
I know. I mean, I have played. I discovered that I was reasonably good at card games, and I was re I'm reasonably good at Trivial Pursuit. I have acquired a lot of general knowledge, apparently.
Useless
But then,
information is in your head.
yes, it's there.
Let's move on, if you don't mind, because I'm so excited about this part of your life. You're embarking on something brand new and something that will be so useful in the world. And that is, Victoria has embarked on a PhD program all around the subject of John Cage's literary works. And so, John Cage as a writer, which really there's not a whole lot out there, as I'm sure you're discovering. You just began, I realize, but you know a lot about Cage and you know a lot about Cage's writings. Victoria, by the way, is a wonderful writer herself. She's also, as you know, has a literary concern called Smith and Brown. She's been an editor. She's done a lot of work with words in her life. So what's happening with your PhD? You've just begun right in the middle of a pandemic, which is just lovely. Where are you living and where is your PhD happening?
The PhD is in Glasgow, and I'm a little bit in limbo because of the pandemic and everything else. So it's going really well. I'm really lucky because most of what John wrote is in print. It's published. It's out in the world. There's no a real struggle for most people in my situation who are beginning or in the middle of PhDs and not being able to get to archives and resources. And I do not have that problem at all. Plus, I have you. I
I
don't know.
work for you right now. I'm working for
I
you.
think it's. I'm going to remind you of that. It is a joy. It really is. I came to John through writing. I'm not a musicologist. I fell in love, as you said in your introduction, I fell in love with Cage and with Merce during an art history lecture. My undergraduate degree was in contemporary art, modern art. I used to teach contemporary art at Sotheby's. That's my background, as well as being a writer. So I've never really come to Cage from a musical or a very deep musical knowledge. So the writings were always the first port of call for me. Him explaining himself directly to me was such an enormous value. So there's my, love of that, and the fact that I've been reading those for more than 20 years now. And then kind of getting to grips with him as a sort of creative writer from the 1970s, I mean 60s really, but really from the 60s and 70s. He has this like incredible practice, which is daunting for a lot of people to read. I think the Mazostics, are slightly off-putting and people don't quite know how to take them. And I think it's going to be really interesting to sort of work with that and think about process and how you talk about those things and how they sit with the rest of what Cage did. And yeah, I mean, I can imagine no better way to be occupied while the world is closed than to have, all of this. I did a project last year with Campoline, which is a small art centre in rural Scotland, and it was based on workshops around Cage's Mazostics, and we were using these letters between Emerson and Carlyle, which kind of loosely connected this little region, which is where Carlyle was from, with Emerson, and therefore with Thoreau, and therefore with Cage. And it was about nature and sound, and it was such a lovely project during the first lockdown, because you're working with other people through a digital format and you're using this process, which is really disciplined but very open and very free and very beautiful, to kind of work with people and crossing the Atlantic with ideas and crossing centuries. And I mean, it's wonderful to read and it's wonderful to do, I suppose. So I feel incredibly lucky to be working on this.
I was talking with Stefano Pucci, the all things Italy guy, about Dark Cage, and he said that the first book, he is in the same situation as you in the sense that he's not really a musician, and his entree to Cage, if you will, was through Cage's writings. And in point of fact, he allowed that the first book that really, really rocked his world, I think, as he put it, was Conversing with Cage. Isn't that interesting? Conversing with Cage, for our listeners, is a book edited by Richard Castellanets, compiled and edited, in which the book is arranged by topics, and there are bits and pieces of Cage's interviews with a variety of people from all over the world. So interviews across many decades, but it's really Cage's thoughts on pedagogy, Cage's thoughts on music and composition, Cage's thoughts on dance. And Stefano just said that it changed his life. And it wasn't until after that that he moved on to Cage's writings per se, Silence, M, Empty Words, A Year from Monday, et cetera. Do you remember what the first book was that you read of Cage? Surely it wasn't a Mazostic.
I think I would have been a bit daunted by this. It was Silence. I mean, it was very early on, it was Silence, and I, like a lot of Cage people, Lecture on Nothing is still one of my very, very, very favorite things. And also not just that, but I'm looking at it. I still have the same copy of The Music of John Cage by James Pritchett that I bought in 1996, 1995, that's been lived with me in different continents. It's never been far from my side. And I remember particularly arriving in New York with three books. It was Beckett's trilogy, that book, and Mercer's Dancing in Space and Time. So I reduced my intellectual luggage to that. Came in through Silence, through that lecture on the kind of event at Black Mountain College, and sort of then went immediately to the library, which was not very far away, and started looking and finding what they had and just reading as much as I possibly could. But to sound very old, it was before the internet. So now, you can Google something of John's, and mostly you can hear it, you can see it, you can watch I've Got a Secret, you can do all of this stuff. And working in Edinburgh University and not having very much spare money, you really didn't have that much access to hear this stuff. So I was mostly reading about it. I mean, even the music library, I remember going to the music library in Edinburgh on George IV Bridge, and they had one recording of Cage, and it was the recording that's by all sorts of like pop culture musicians. So they had a recording of 4:33 by Frank Zappa.
I remember this. It was called, oh my God, I can't
I'm
remember. It
Cage.
happened in the archives. Uncaged,
Yeah.
maybe, maybe.
Something like, I remember it from working on the discography that, yeah, it's there. So that was the first Cage I got to hear.
But your work, your background begs a question, and that is, you said you learned about Cage in an art history course within the context of an art history class. Was there an awareness at the time in that course or elsewhere of Cage's visual artwork? No. So it was just the ideas. It was just the philosophical positioning of Cage relative to all of the art forms.
Yeah, and in that one in particular, it was talking about, really, it was about Rauschenberg. That lecture would have been about Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, and they were talking about the events of Black Mountain College, and well, maybe leading into Capro and happenings. So, that sort of, that kind of 50s, 60s kind of moment. in American art. It would have been a part, of course, called American Modernism, if I'm remembering correctly. But no, that there wasn't such an awareness of Cage as a visual artist or a writer or anything.
Well, Cage as a writer is definitely, I mean, I said it before, but it bears repeating. It is the least understood, really. It's the least written about as a body of work. No one's really looked in a sensible way at all of the different kind of stages of Cage as a writer. The first writings being sort of just general music criticism for Middle America and the Herald Tribune back in the late 40s and very early 50s. But then moving on, I remember his good friend Minna Daniel. I think Minna died before you got there. Or did you ever meet Minna?
I didn't, but I remember you talking about her.
Yeah, she was wonderful. She was a legendary editor. I'm blocking the name of her magazine. When it comes to me, I'm going to pop it into this recording. But anyway, I remember visiting with her. She and Cage were long, long, long time friends. She lived out in the country, not so far from where John lived in Stony Point. So they became fast friends. But at any rate, I digressed there. But I remember her showing me her library when I was visiting her when she lived in Manhattan. And she was standing in front of this library and she said, "Ugh, too much Cage." And she was just looking at all the publications by Cage. And she, as an editor, as a publisher, as a person who was involved in giving voice to American composers as writers, really international composers as writers in her Modern Music was the name of her publication, really important Modern Music. And she bemoaned Cage's development of the misostic form because we lost him as a prose writer, as a storyteller, as a narrator. And he was so wonderful at those. And she really bemoaned the loss of that. They were always on the verge of breakup, their friendship. She was constantly furious with him, and he was constantly making up for what he was never quite sure, but they were very, very close. But like is a funny word to use there. You enjoy his misostics. Do you enjoy them do you enjoy them for the same reason he wrote them, which is the juxtapositioning of voices, the brushing of information against information, so to speak?
I love them because of the process and the structure, and I think that's why I love John overall. I mean, Reunion is a structure, Misostic writing is a structure, and you apply the rules and but there's still a little bit of work for you in there, but there are rules to kind of follow, and I love that. And to have found so many different ways of doing things is, I think, quite remarkable.
I think that even his use of chance operations, which is not well understood by most people, was this interplay between setting up a structure and then unwinding it through your work, allowing whatever happens to happen, and that he was happiest with the outcome when he had thought through all the possible permutations of chance. You know, what could happen if I used this many in a gamut of sounds? What could happen if I allow this to be in the dark or gradations of light? What could happen? And then carrying it out. I think he took incredible pleasure in doing that. And I began to play also in the same way with chance operations myself, not long after I met him and we started working together. And I just fell in love with it. It just is so, it's sort of like the balance between two sides of the brain in a nice way. It uses the analytic, it uses the clerical, if you will, the kind of orderliness of one side of your brain, and then the absolute wantonness of the other side. So it plays back and forth. And when I've done workshops in the past around Cage's, they're called the Ryoanji drawings. So these rock tracing works that really are based on chance operations with regard to your materials. I start off immediately talking with people about that the process is a real balance between chance and choice. What are the elements of choice that you bring into play? And then subjecting those things of choice to chance. It short circuits anybody's supposedly, wise kind of comment, well, it's not all chance. I mean, he chose to use chance, things like that. I've heard them all. It really, you get, when you work with chance, you begin to see how it's not just chance operations. It's chance operations applied to deeply thought out questions about your materials, about your situation, about all the parameters that are involved in the creation of anything. Have you used chance?
I mean, I must have. I've definitely not used necessarily Cage's exact processes, but sort of bounced off them a little bit. Like the thesaurus I made for Glasgow International kind of plays with that of like running words through a thesaurus, and it's a Cagean process, but it's not a process Cage specifically used.
We have to wrap up. Is there anything? I know that we could talk forever, as I said at the start, and we can certainly do this again. If you want to focus on something in particular, we can have another conversation. Victoria, it's a pleasure as always. She and I have taken this opportunity provided by the pandemic to have FaceTime audio conversations every week. So we probably talk more now that there's a pandemic than we did before. So thank you so much, Victoria, and take very, very good care of yourself.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now let's listen to the sounds captured at the first game, which are included on a 33 RPM flexi disc in Shigeko Kubota's publication, Marcel Duchamp and John Cage Reunion.
That's the hand of mine.
Now he kept saying, just remember where you are, that you're not in, you're not in your living room.
Start pat on the board for the first
wow.
move.
Je crois que c'est plutôt déjà. Qu'est-ce que sont ces choses qui poussent à...
We're ready, yeah. Are you ready?
Okay. You see these balls.
We're ready.
You can move. Juste ce que tu dis.
Ah oui.
C'est marqué.
You can move when you choose now. Huh? You can move when you choose.
All right. Okay.
No, but it was still the king's power.
Thank you. No, we can't.
We have to take it. All right. I have a kind of article set. Everything's
all right. Oh, you have
it to the hotel? I have it
here. Yeah.